it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History.
Win.
We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Oi, oi, I'm Jimmy Bullard, and this is me old muck of Fenners. We're back together, son. How are ya?
Hi, Bully. Great to be back working with you. Well, what are we doing here, though?
We're starting a football club in podcast form. The only thing we know, it's called FC Bullard. After that, it's all up for grabs.
So, we haven't got any players, we haven't got a kit, we haven't got a club badge, we haven't got a stadium.
Correct. FC Bullard. Welcome to the club.
Hello and welcome to your Monday review of round four of the Six Nations. Slightly later than normal, as we only just stopped celebrating one of the best games ever seen at Twickenham. England ended Ireland's Grand Slam hopes with a stoppage time winner courtesy of the one and only Marcus Smith with an unbelievable drop goal. Absolute scenes after. And not only that, what a win for Italy over Scotland in Rome.
Bellissimo.
For the love of rugby.
And what a weekend it was. There's a lot to discuss. It's me, Ben Youngs. No Dan Cole today. We may have a voice note, though. However, we are joined by Tom Fordyce. Hello, Tom. What a weekend, mate.
Hey, Ben. Nice to see ya. It was pretty remarkable, Ben, wasn't it? I was thinking back. It did bring back memories of that remarkable final weekend in 2015 when Wales beat Italy to go top of the table and then Ireland beat Scotland to leapfrog them and England very nearly beat France in a ridiculous match by a ridiculous margin. But it's pretty much up there. We've had a lot of messages on the socials over the weekend, understandably reflecting on the madness. If you want to get in touch, use Love of Rugby on the socials. Here is one from Laura Harris, Ben. Laura says, Twickenham was bouncing, great atmosphere, best birthday present. Laura, we get the hint, happy birthday to you. One from Joseph Davis. Joseph says, World Cup vibes with the drop goal win. I assume he's talking about 2003. Best I've seen England play in a while, but also room to grow. And Ben, we have a question for you from H Banks 8. And it's one of those questions that's either genius or not, and I can't quite work it out. See what you think. Do you see the game as an Irish loss or an England win?
It is a genius question, you're right. I see it as an England win, absolutely. Because given the form that Ireland are in, given the expectation of Ireland coming to Twickenham, 2 weeks build-up and all that, but equally England, you know, disappointment of Murrayfield, having started the game so promisingly and well. You know, I thought they came out the blocks. They played with speed. They played with precision. You know, passes that weren't sticking 2 weeks ago were sticking. The strikes looked good. We had synergy. There's so many good things to be excited about. And I absolutely loved it. We didn't let Ireland settle. We imposed ourselves. So without doubt, in my opinion, it was definitely an England win rather than an Irish loss.
Right, so the final score, if you were somehow on another planet and didn't see it, haven't read or heard anything about it since, England 23, Ireland 22. Let's get into this, Ben. There were reports in the week quoting this very podcast. Okay, do you think England have been working on their attack based on what you saw on Saturday?
Without doubt. And it's not as if they hadn't been, but everything just stuck. You know, we saw the quality that married up in terms of their skill and their execution to the players that we have at our disposal. And I really, really enjoyed seeing them play with tempo and speed and move the ball. I thought our balance was so good in terms of our kick to run ratio and understanding that when we need to shift and move it. And ultimately, we were camped in Ireland's half for majority of the first half. And we just imposed ourselves and didn't allow Ireland to settle. Like if we look at the first try, for instance, so it goes back to James Lowe in the boot, who's got a very, very good kick, but he kicks it long, it bounces, Furbank gets it, and the intent straight away on the bounce is he is going for it. So he catches it on the bounce, no indecision, boom, climbs over halfway, gets on the 45, so he's opening up the field. We are attacking them. Great ball to Tommy Freeman, who actually rides a hell of a hit from Nash, bless him, who has to go off injured with a HIA, unfortunately, but great read from him in terms of him making the decision. But Tommy Freeman wears the tackle unbelievably well. England get lightning quick ball. They then take that edge, just quick hands, nice and square. But because Nash is lost in that tackle and obviously down and out, Robbie Henshaw's actually on the edge there. And if you watch it back, Gibson Park's calling for extra help. Robbie Henshaw's on the edge, and he actually ends up backtracking. And England just go hard at the inside shoulder, pick him off with great hands. Lawrence on the outside goes around the last defender. Brilliant try. And like the atmosphere and the Twickenham, like everyone was on their feet, and it was just awesome to see. But that start and that not allowing Ireland to get into their flow, and England taking the game to Ireland was so good. And it was just like the atmosphere, Tom, like the crowd was right behind them at that point. It was class.
Twickenham's a funny place sometimes, Ben, isn't it? We've discussed this on previous pods, but matches that England start well seem to encourage the crowd, who then start encouraging England. Matches where England start poorly or a little bit slowly, it can all go a little bit quiet. But we got to half time. This was the puzzling thing, I think, watching it. My worry for England at that point was that they were going to the dressing room thinking, well, we've done pretty much everything we wanted to do. Okay, we've left a few points out there off the tee with George Ford. But in terms of the performance, in terms of the patterns, pretty much everything that England would have wanted. But Ireland were leading 12 points to 8. And I looked at that Ireland performance. I thought, Ireland have barely got out of second gear here. But this is almost like the All Blacks. They've barely got out of second gear. They've been into the English 22 maybe three times. And yet they're 4 points up.
And that's the thing. I was sitting in the stands. I was thinking, like, England played all the rugby. Ireland look a little bit disjointed. They look kind of shocked, and that's because England imposed themselves and didn't allow Ireland to settle. And the way England were playing, and you're thinking, it's all England, right? And as you say, it was 12-8, and you're thinking, well, that's compliment to Ireland in terms of hanging in there and being that New Zealand-esque in terms of when they're not necessarily playing at their best or on the back foot, but still going ahead at half time. And from an England's point of view, I think half time, all you got to be thinking is, we are playing some great stuff, and it will come. And it will come, and you're getting all the right messages. The scoreline isn't what you want in your favour, but you're dominant in most areas. And then, boom, straight after half time, Ireland strike. So it's like double blow, the kick just before half time, and then immediately after half time, when everyone's regrouped and got their key messages, you come out thinking, boys, keep playing like this. We're gonna break them. It's gonna come. We're playing the rugby. We're on top here. And then Ireland strike straight away. So they obviously kick the box kick. The ball goes up. They regather, unbelievable catch, and then they go into that arrowhead shape, which we've talked a lot about in this pod before, and it goes out the back to 10, the blitz comes up, and he just pumps the pass, invites Slade to go forward a little bit more, that gives him a little corridor, and then they all flood through, and once you get behind the blitz, you know, it's scrambled offence. I think England did unbelievably well to actually scramble. There's some big hits coming in the cover, but James Lowe in the corner, and Ireland score, and at this point, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, we've had like a brilliant first half, and we look like the better team, and they've just double whammed us like a New Zealand would. And you're thinking, oh no, we don't deserve this. We've been dominant. We've been so good. It's cruel, right?
So what is the turning point then, Ben? Because I think probably quite a few people who've seen this England team maybe over the course of the last year, and definitely those who've been watching Ireland since the World Cup, would be expecting Ireland to stretch away. Was it the point? It was, I think, about 57 minutes. England steal that Irish line out, shift it. We get Benny Earl with what is now a trademark Ben Earl break. And then Peter O'Mahony gives away the penalty yellow card. That felt like a big tipping point.
It was a huge swing, absolute huge swing. You know, having scored already with George Furbank scoring that try just before as well, I thought George Furbank sort of ignited England's attack at times, especially with the first try in terms of how he just carried it over halfway, shifted to Freeman. His connection in terms of the other try, you know, organising the forwards, getting out the back of that pod as Underhill then carried a Marrow and he tipped up on the outside. But when you look at the key turning point, as you mentioned, Tom, absolutely, 57 minutes, England steal the ball. That man again, Ben Earl, gets it as quick as a back three runner. Through he goes, off he goes, clean break, crowd on their feet. And then cynical by Peter O'Mahony, and rightly so, goes to the bin. And England now have all the momentum again. We then kick to corner. We go through the phases, build pressure. And before you know it, our power game comes to the party. And it is that man again, Ben Earl, who crosses over. And again, it's like the crowd. And you could just sense now, like, momentum's with England. Like, here we go. And it was just basically the dam broke, essentially, didn't it, through that power game on that try.
Let's talk briefly about Ben Earl, because he was named player of the match. He's one of those players, and you get this sense when you are in the stands at Twickenham, he is already something of a folk hero, partly because of the way he plays the game and partly because of the impact he's having. But he is now not just doing it in one-off games for England, he is consistently making a difference in the big games.
He is. He's had an incredible season in an England shirt, and he is fast becoming so influential in terms of how England play and his ability to either affect us in terms of how we attack with his ball carrying, his breaks, his ability in wide channels, his ability in close quarters as well. You know, he is a phenomenal athlete, but equally as well, how he is and he jackals and he gets over the ball and he slows that down, but he gives a huge amount of energy. Like, he never gets tired. You know, you'd argue, is seven his best position, is eight, is six? It doesn't matter. Just get him on the field and have him on the field. I think he's been an absolute standout player for England. And Ben Earl has had huge, huge moments consistently in an England shirt now for at least 12 months. And it's brilliant to see.
So in large part down to people like Ben Earl, England now have the momentum back. Ireland then lose both wingers. Scrum half Gibson Park has to fill in on the wing for the final 25 minutes. Now, we have seen opposition scrum halves move out to the wing at Twickenham before, and without wanting to remind you, Ben, all over again about the 2015 World Cup when Lloyd Williams did it for Wales. In the group stages of that tournament, it didn't work out too badly for Wales, but it seemed to disrupt Ireland, and as good as Gibson Park's hands were for Lowe's second try towards the end, right, he's not a natural born winger, but also great player that Conor Murray has been and still is. There is something about Gibson Park playing nine for Ireland. He's a different sort of threat, isn't he? And it felt to me like Ireland missed his threat at nine as much as they sort of bemoaned his appearance on the wing, if that makes sense.
It does. And he brings a huge amount of tempo to Ireland's play. Like, he brings speed of ball. And that's what England got. England got huge speed of ball this weekend. And when Gibson Park moved to the wing, that's a really tough challenge. So Ireland's obviously backfield then had to change. You know, he's covering the kicks, he's doing all that. And he's an unbelievably talented footballer, as you mentioned, Tom. Like, that try, that catch and give, like Bowden Barrett, those guys, you know, those outside backs, you expect standards like that, you know, they would be proud of that. That catch, pass and release and putting low away. Phenomenal from him. But what it would have affected as well is their strikes. So suddenly you're going for scrums, you're going off lineouts, and you've got a nine on the wing. And then you're looking at Aki to almost carry, and you haven't got like any subtlety around that. And I think that's where it becomes very, very difficult. Also kick chase, you know, in terms of when Murray goes in the air and trying to field box kicks back, you know, Gibson Park chasing and what that looks like. Equally as a nine, you're so used to chasing breakdowns, there's got to be an element of him thinking, I need to stay back. So, you know, that does have an effect on Ireland, and it would have. What I liked with England is they tried to exploit it. They went on and kicked on him a couple of times. He actually gathered it, but, you know, they tried to really sort of pressure him and put him under pressure. And that's just smart rugby, really.
Right. What is everyone on that pitch thinking about as the clock is ticking down? It's a 2-point lead for Ireland. Ireland have possession in their half. Conor Murray decides to kick to touch. So first of all, talk me through that decision to kick to touch rather than keeping the ball in play or trying to go through a few more phases. And then also, let's talk about that extraordinary last couple of minutes when England do have the ball back.
You know, a lot of people have different views in terms of what a nine should do there. Do you go through the phases, try and run down the clock? Now, there's a couple of things to that. You're away from home. There's jackal threats about Ben Earl that we mentioned. You've got Dom Brandt on there at that point that can jackal. You've got guys that can get over the ball, Theo Dan that can get over a ball. So if you go through the phases, you know, the chances are guys are going in there and they are trying to nick it. So you can get a holding on pen. Right, there's a 2-point game. The other thing as well, ref could do you for sealing off and things like that. The ball squirts out. So in my opinion, Connor's done exactly the right thing. Right, kick the ball off, go to a set piece. Back your set piece, back your line-out defence, back your organisation off a line-out and do that. So they decide to kick off. And then it's like really interesting, the chain of events, and I'll try and break it down for the listeners in terms of what it looks like. So Ireland kick it off. It's obviously the last play. A lot of teams would probably maul off that. Maul it, try and squeeze a penalty out. But I loved how England went off the top, like off the top. And it kind of epitomised their whole mindset throughout the game, which was to go at Ireland and attack them. And I think it was just brilliant to see. So off the top they go and they run a strike. They go out the back, Dom Brandt, and then out the back again. And Tommy Freeman carries, right? And he carries sort of around the 15-metre mark or just inside. Ireland hit him. Henshaw hits him. A couple of back rows get in there. And they're trying to catch tackle, which is hold the attacker up. And if you hold him up, the ref will signal a maul, the ball goes down, unplayable, game over, Ireland win. Right, so James Lowe and a couple others are sort of lingering around this sort of catch tackle, thinking, hold him up. And the game makes you do funny things when the game's on the line. You chase things, you're trying to come up with a big play to nip it in the bud, right? So James Lowe actually ends up right next to that breakdown where he's a bit like, do I go in and try and hold him up or do I stay out? and he sort of half goes in, then half stays out. By this point, Marcus Smith's recognised, come around the same way. So he's come around the same way. Danny's hit him on the same way. James Lowe, who would be on that left-hand wing, is but next to the breakdown. Bundiaki's now that last defender. Marcus gets it, skips on a little overs. Feo Obosu gets it on overs, who I thought was absolutely electric. Loved him. I think, wow, we found a star there. Takes Aki on the outside. Now, Lowe would have been there had he not been lured in by this catch tackle, trying to sort of stop momentum and come up with a big play, which pressure creates that, right? So he creates this bend outside Aki, steps back in field, which is brilliant. Rugby 101 for all those young wingers out there. Get in field. Don't get tackled into touch. Get in field, which he does. James Lowe, in his credit, actually gets back and now tackles him. Again, through like desperation of coming up with big plays. By tackling him and Feo Obosu having brilliant momentum, James Lowe's then trapped. So then we get a penalty or advantage for not rolling away. So at this point, you're thinking, as an English point of view, brilliant, we've got advantage, free play, let's go. From an Irish point of view, you have to kill the ball. You have to cheat. You have to get jackalers in there, hands in there. You cannot let that ball come out, because that penalty's about 7 metres in from touch. And we'll never know whether England would have gone corner or post. But from an honest perspective, like, the penalty's been given, kill it, stop it. Like, don't make him have to deal with the pressure of kicking, whatever. But they don't. We then get momentum again. I think Will Stewart carries, a couple others carry, and we go all the way. We then get to the left-hand side, and then Tadhg Burns, and he almost does what could have probably happened in the advantage earlier, where he just thinks, they say, advantage, and he's like, this ball ain't coming out. Like, this ball isn't, to the point where the ref's just like, right, let go now, please. Like, he can't like hold on to it any longer. Anyway, out it comes out the back to Marcus, who just obviously slots it. Brilliant, brilliant composure from him to get it over, of course. But we obviously had the free play on that. In fact, you know, to advantage, we'd have been able to choose which penalty, but takes it rather than having to have the shot at goal. I was just so pleased to see England bring out a performance that was so encouraging. They played with pace. They played with ambition. We saw cohesion. Things that, like I say, weren't sticking 2 weeks ago stuck, and it was so refreshing. And they were so deserved of winning that game. And they had to do it the hard way by coming back a number of times. And that also is a big, big, big plus in terms of their mentality and mindset. So it was a great day for England. And I felt very privileged to have been there watching and cheering them on.
What do we think about the Marcus Smith, George Ford discussion? Because sometimes, Ben, we can all focus on the final acts and what feels like the decisive acts. And in this case, Marcus came on, was really, really good. He's got that lovely club-level understanding with Danny Kerr at 9, and he obviously kicks the winning drop goal. But do you think, actually, despite the 7 points that George Ford might have left out there on the kicking tee, do you think that actually George was as essential to that victory as Marcus?
Without doubt, George Ford is such a clever tactician. So much of good England attack came through George. So much of the good field position that he got in terms of his spiral bombs, in terms of his tactical kicking game, was superb, allowing England to maintain such a dominant sort of territory battle. And the game was then set up for someone like Marcus to come on and chase it. And this weekend against France, you've got to go with George. You've got to go with the experience. He's been there, he's done it. And I thought he's been really, really important and brilliant for England over this period. And he's shown his worth once again. And I think Marcus coming on is a great thing to have as well, because with Danny, that connection, that understanding at Quinn's, they've played a huge amount of games together at club level, and that synergy is really important. But I think the beauty of it is test match rugby can be quite an arm wrestle early on, and George just manages that so well, whilst also having the ability to move the ball and do all those bits. And if you're chasing the game, and if you've got 20 minutes or so to go against France this weekend, when their packs are a bit heavy, you've got to let Marcus then out them. And I think it's a really nice, I think they're going to really compliment each other about that. And, you know, George starting and setting the tone and almost facilitating this, what test match is early on, and then Marcus coming in at the back end of the game and adding that bit of zip, I guess, you know, challenging and all those bits, and especially against a French pack this weekend, which hopefully will be under fatigued, and I'm sure England will want to push the tempo of the game and push the speed at which they play and create fatigue in France. Then Marcus coming on for George at the back end of the game, I think there's a real compliments each other's strengths.
I think we need to big up a couple of other England players as well here, Ben, before we wrap on this game. George Martin, Ollie Chesham, 22 and 23 years old, What can you tell us as England's most capped men's rugby union international? What can you tell us about their performances on the field that the likes of me and many of our listeners who will never play international rugby might not notice?
Oh, look, they do a lot of unseen stuff. They do stuff that you can see, of course. You know, the line-out steals. Chez got in there. Ollie got in there a couple of times and stole line-outs. But it's more than that. It's the grunt they bring around the field. So George Martin, like, I mean, he is up there with Sam Underhill in terms of if he hits you, you stay it. It's like, you know, when you're driving down a motorway on a summer's day and the bug hits a windscreen, that's like running into George Martin. He just stops you in your tracks. And he's added a real sort of, you never want to say like enforcer, because that's a word for other people to call him, right? But he's fast becoming a big physical sort of talisman within the England pack, yet he's still only 22 and Chez is only 23. But what we've found is two brilliant athletes that are able to mix at international level and impose themselves physically. It's a great position to England have that we've got two guys that are going to have the best part of probably a decade in the engine room producing performances like they did at the weekend.
One other thing I want to just touch on a little bit more, Ben. We've talked about George Furbank. The social media world that we live in, there are always a few trolls knocking around. There seems to be a few people who want to criticise George Furbank, so let's help them out. In 30 seconds, can you explain his role to people who might not get it yet?
I think first and foremost, people are just totally outcome-based, you know, and it's not the point. So George ignited that first try. He caught the ball on the bounce and he engaged the Ireland defence and off he went. And he sparked everyone into life in the England attack. On his try as well, his organisation out the back of shape was phenomenal in terms of getting the forwards in the right position to create space, create opportunities. And I think that's exactly why he's probably been given the nod at the moment, is to create those opportunities and be an extra distributor ball player and see space that maybe other guys don't potentially see or come as natural for them. But he sees it and he organises, gets them in the right position. And he's like that extra distributor. So, you know, I think he's done a huge amount of good things. And I think people just, you know, they get hung up on, you know, one mistake or two mistakes. And actually, there's so much broader things that he brings to that. And I thought he's actually played a very, very good game.
Right, my phone has just buzzed and I've just seen you look down and look at your phone. I've got a feeling we may have a voice note here from Mr. Dan Cole. Let's play them now and then we'll go to an ad break.
Hello, Ben and Tom. Sorry I can't be with you today. Obviously, I'm occupied elsewhere, put it that way. But I'm sure there are a couple of questions you'd like answering. Firstly, how does it feel to have beaten Ireland? And the feeling is obviously very good. I think beforehand we were kind of written off in the press and stuff, and Ireland are obviously a fantastic team, but for us to perform in the manner which we did, I think, you know, really attacking from the off and going at the Irish team, you know, had we not won at the end, it would have been a performance that was still we could be sort of proud of. But I think the manner in which we won with the drop goal right at the end was phenomenal. I think, you know, you heard how Twickenham was rocking and yeah, it was brilliant, which obviously led to some good celebrations afterwards. Nothing too heavy, because obviously we've got to play France this weekend and don't really want to go into them with a stinking hangover. So, yeah, but I say Twickenham was buzzing, and I think, you know, that fed into the players, the groups and the families that were there. In terms of where's it rank in my career, it's definitely up there. I think, you know, there's not many test matches I think I've won the final kick of the game, especially at home and against probably the best team in the world. So, yeah, that was... it's one of the best ones, the one I think I'll remember for a while. And obviously with Danny Kerr's 100th as well, has added sort of importance for him and for the team. And yeah, it was a really good good occasion. And hopefully we can take that forward into this week. Obviously playing the French, they're coming off a big win against Wales. And they're a different animal to Ireland. I think you look at the size of the pack and the skill they've got, it's going to be a different challenge, but one that we are going to have to be very prepared for and we'll spend a week preparing for. Obviously playing them in Lyon is going to be different and exciting, so very much looking forward to that. In terms of the game plan here, our intention was to start fast. I think you want to start fast in any test match, but especially at home. I think coming off the back of a loss, obviously there might have been a bit of apprehension around Twickenham, and I think, you know, starting fast, trying to get 80,000 people behind you was big for the team. You know, we spoke about, again, starting fast, and I think it probably added, having lost to Scotland and having the you know, the performance we did, we wanted to come out and in some regards not throw the first punch, but just be in the game and show off our intent of how we wanted to play. And we spent the past 2 weeks working on, and I think it showed. I think probably, you know, we started fast, but Ireland were able to get back into the game. And probably one thing the group can be proud of, is the team can be proud of, is the fact that probably against Scotland, we, you know, when the going got tough and we got hit by a couple of tries, we sort of probably went away from what we were good at. Whereas against Ireland, we stayed in the fight. We kept going back to what we knew, kept on trying to go toe-to-toe with them, and showed at the end. You know, I think we had 14 blokes on the field because Chandler had to go off with his leg injury. But, you know, we kept going, and that's the final fastest play. We had 14 blokes on the field, but, you know, we had the momentum with us.
Tom, how good was that hearing from Coley? Let's leave him to prepare for France. He'll be back with me on Thursday, but let the Cola Bear relax and get himself ready for what's going to be a big old French pack.
I have a couple of other questions about the England game before we move on to the other two games this weekend. First of all, Benno, we've talked about a little bit. He just looks like he's taken to international rugby like a duck to water. I also liked his chat after the game, Ben. So he won player of the match. And afterwards he said, apparently we're the worst England team ever. We've done pretty well for that accolade, right? These are the sort of things that when you're a journalist, you sort of think, none of us said you were the worst England team ever. We just said you didn't play particularly well against Scotland. But at the same time, it's always nice when someone takes a little bit of umbrage at that and enjoys shoving it down people's throats, even if they haven't actually said it.
No, absolutely, mate. And do you know what? I think what England have done, because... And I guess that's the thing. I don't sense from anyone that they think they're the worst team ever. That's just not the case at all. If anything, everyone is so behind this team and understands how much talent we have and how good they can be. And we saw that against Ireland, and that was what was so refreshing. And I guess Scotland game, for 20 minutes, we were brilliant. 10-0 up at Murrayfield, perfect start after 20 minutes. And then, obviously, we know how it ended. But you're like, oh, like... this team is so bloody good and talented. And we mentioned it on the pod. Like, we've got wonderful players, gifted players, brilliant players. And I guess no one thinks that. It's like the fact of like the expectation and we're aware of how good this team could be. And we just want it to be good. And we want it to be brilliant. And we saw that. And that was all so good. But equally, I know that, you know, having been in camp and being in these situations where you're back against the wall a little bit, you feel like people are writing you off. You feel like maybe... everyone's looking in and got a lot of opinions. Actually, it galvanises you. And I love that England have obviously used all this bit of a fuel. You know, the disappointment of Murrayfield, created this sort of narrative in terms of like, you know, no one rates us. We can't do this. We can't do that. We ain't going to beat Ireland. We're the underdogs and all that. And you know what? Use that as emotional fuel. It's produced an unbelievable performance. So, you're right in terms of what you say, Tom. It's like... Benny Earl has been phenomenal, and I love it, and I love watching him play, and he's now what he probably is the most valuable forward we have. He is so influential to that England team in terms of what he does, but also the energy he gives, and I love it. So, you know, it's brilliant, and he's been absolute class, and we'll need him again on Saturday against France.
So he's been around the England setup not for a long time, but for a little bit of time compared to Manny Faye-Wiboso, who... impressed everyone with his little cameo against Scotland, totally earned his first start, and his first start, he totally justified starting again against France. He looks totally at home, particularly, Ben, for a player who has risen so quickly through the ranks at club level as well.
Without doubt, mate. You're looking at him, you're thinking like he's an athlete, like an absolute athlete. But like you could sense it yesterday at Twickenham, right? Every time he got the ball, it was like this expectation, this like excitement in the air. It was like, oh, what can he do? And I think what he's also got is a massive point of difference in terms of we don't have necessarily the most physical of wingers, although Tommy Freeman can ride a tackle, as he showed against Nash. Take some of that, son. And but Faye-Wiboso gave us some carry. Well, we've obviously got Ollie Lawrence give us some carry, but he gave us some carry. We used him off strikes. He got us some momentum. You know, he looked dangerous. The break he made at the end, as we mentioned, like, that's great wing play. Like, he's taking him on the outside, but what he's been smart enough to go, I've got to get in field now. I've got to get in field. And he's powerful. He nearly broke the tackle. So I think England have found an absolute rising star. Now, you know, sometimes these guys burst in the scene, you don't want to put too much expectation on them, but I'm genuinely really excited about where his future goes and how impressive he can continue to be. But you could sense it already. The crowd, like, this guy's going to have some big moments in an England shirt, and I love seeing him out there do it. And I think he certainly grabs his opportunity with both hands, and you're looking at him thinking, yeah, we've found someone there. We really have. I'm excited by him.
So he's a couple of caps into his international career. We need to talk about your old mucker, Danny Kerr, who made his 100th appearance for England off the bench. And it was a very Danny sort of cameo. We've talked about that club understanding he has with Marcus Smith. But even in that final push that England had when they've gone quickly off that line out, Danny was really quick to recognise that Marcus had come round the corner, which then led to the pass out to Faye Wabusa on the right wing. It was a really nice way for Danny to do it, but also, quite apart from the fact that it was his 100th cap, it was exactly what you want your replacement nine to do.
Yeah, the synergy between Marcus and Danny is outstanding, as it should be, you know, given the amount of times they've played together at club level. But, you know, the speed of ball he brings, the calmness as well. And, you know, Marcus, although he, you know, he's literally played for Quins when he was in nappies and he seems like he's been around for ages, is still relatively inexperienced when it comes to test level. So for him to have Danny inside and winning his 100th cap, which might be the first to say, incredible achievement. And we obviously did a pod on him in the week. So unbelievable to see him get out there. You know, the crowd on their feet, standing ovation, rightly so, recognises what an unbelievable servant he has been for England and continues to be for England. But as we mentioned, him and Marcus and that tempo and that understanding that Marcus is coming around and the recognition of space. So, yeah, it, again, had a big impact, a big say in it, as he always has for England for many, many years. I thought it was great to see Danny also walk out with his family, get that opportunity. How brilliant would that be? I wouldn't know that because I walked out to a COVID empty Rome with Jamie George. Not that I'm jealous. So, no, great for Danny. To do that. And then of course, you know, his youngest at the end with the microphone trying to eat it, chew it, do all things the babies do. So no, great for Danny and his family. What an unbelievably proud day. So and to get the win in the drama that it was, like, you almost couldn't wish for a better 100th to mark the special occasion.
So we always get loads of questions, Ben, on our socials. If you want to fire a question Ben's way, just search for Love of Rugby. Here is one from Sam Doyle on Insta. Sam says, is that a level England can consistently reach? It seemed very emotionally fueled. That's a really good question. What do you think, Ben?
It's a cracking question. Rugby is built on emotion. It has a big part of it. And I, you know, the 2-week build-up to this game and England understand they need to be at their best. But what they've probably done is giving themselves a load of confidence and belief. And I thought the balance of play, right? England sometimes get criticised for maybe not playing enough rugby, but the balance of which they played yesterday, they moved the ball, they had play pace, their tempo, passes were sticking, which they weren't sticking up Murrayfield, strikes were working that weren't working up at Murrayfield. And we saw a totally different galvanised, cohesive England. And that was what's so good. So without doubt, they can replicate it. And I think if anything, you know, beating Ireland, who arguably, you know, South Africa world champions, but arguably the best team in the world currently, you would say that doesn't give you anything but confidence. And I thought just the way they approached it and did it was absolutely outstanding. So going to France this week, what an awesome opportunity to go back up. And I really believe they will. I believe they'll go to France, they'll go to Lyon, and they'll do the business against the French. And they'll finish the tournament with a lot of momentum leading into the summer tour.
Right, let's move on to the first game on Saturday. Now, the drama started early. Italy's first home win since 2013, which seems ridiculous, but it's true. They held on at the end to beat Scotland 31 points to 29. Ben, there is always talk about relegation from the Six Nations. It never gets that serious, but if I were an Italian player, it would really wind me up. But they've been good in this championship. Probably should have beaten France last time out if Garbisi hadn't had that nightmare off the kick and tee at the end. They got Wales next weekend. It's quite conceivable they could finish this championship with two wins and a draw.
Absolutely, mate. And I look at it and I think, you're right, they could have been 2 from 2 had the ball not fallen off. I thought they're absolutely deserving of their win. You know, Italy, Scotland score straight after half time, right? But it's pulled back for obstruction. And then literally 3 minutes, so it would have gone to 29-16. 29-16, you're thinking the game would have been over. And having also come back from the start of the game of 14-3 down, you know, they come back and then you're looking at that straight after half time, goes to 29-16, but it's pulled back for obstruction. 2 minutes later, Italy then scored. Louis Leiner, on debut, becomes an Italian legend with a brilliant recognition of space in behind the line, grubber kick, regather, exploiting the space as they exploited the first try with a chip over the top. Definitely something they went into the game tactically with. Great finish from Louis Leiner. And you're like, Italy can do this, right? And they're looking like they win it. And then Scotland then score with a couple of minutes to go. And you're looking at that grandstand finish. And I'm watching it like, Italy, don't give away a penalty. Just hang in there, hang in there. And they were so deserving of their win. And like you say, Tom, could have easily been 2-2 right now. And you're looking at them at Wales and you're thinking, Italy could win this. And regarding that, you know, the question with the relegation, for a while that brought up, but I think that's absolutely dead in the water now. There's no chat of that. Italy bring an exciting brand. I'm enjoying watching them play. And yeah, I think they've added so much in this tournament. And, you know, you cannot take them lightly anymore.
Right, so if that is one cliche about Italy, Ben, that they deserve to be relegated when they don't necessarily need to be relegated at all, is it a cliche that when we talk about Scotland, that it's often this way, that they beat England and they look fantastic and they don't back it up? So is it fair to talk about Scotland as being inconsistent, or is this actually, with this Scotland team, is it more about expectation? Is there an expectation from non-Scots, because of the big wins, that they should be doing it more regularly than they do? And is there maybe an expectation from Scotland themselves, having talked themselves up a little bit?
Oh, I think there's a bit of everything, really. Because you look at the World Cup, right, and, you know, they pushed Africa not too bad in the first, you know, in the pool game. You know, they come unstuck, but they didn't beat them. And then you look at the Ireland game, it's all, and everyone was, like, engrossed on that final pool game, and Ireland absolutely banged them. And the beginning of this tournament, again, you're looking at it and there's a lot of expectation on Scotland, a lot of like, okay, this is their year, if it's now or never. They play a game plan and a style that's actually really easy on the eye. And everyone sort of enjoys watching them, right? But it doesn't necessarily transpire to victories and you get a little bit of inconsistency. So you've seen them like have an unbelievable first half against Wales. Then Wales nearly come back and beat them. So you sort of see the highs of Scotland and the lows all in one game. Then you nearly beat France, but the try is disallowed at the end. So you got heartbreak and what could have been. Then you go to round three, and obviously it's the biggest game for any Scotland player, biggest game for any Scotland fan, beating England, beating the old enemy. And they do that. So then you're thinking, right, Scotland are right back in the mix. And they do what they normally do on the back of beating England, is they cannot back it up. So I love to see it. But I don't want to take anything away from the Italians, because they were phenomenal and I want to give them credit. But Scotland, if you're a Scotland fan right now, you're scratching your head a little bit in terms of the inconsistency. And as they move forward to the Aviva this weekend, you're not really sure what you're going to get. They've got a free swing at it and they can go there and there's no expectations and they're going to be fueled by the disappointment of this weekend. But you don't know what you're going to get with Scotland at the moment. And I feel like there's almost a clock ticking, because they've had a golden era. You've got Finn Russell, who's a phenomenal player and makes things happen. But it's almost like, at what stage are they going to grab the opportunity and win the tournament? And if it's not this year, then when is it? Because I just feel like, you know, Hogg's retired. Finn Russell's obviously still there, an absolute talisman. But these players are now going to start going. That generation, the opportunity to actually win the tournament now are starting to decline. I felt like it was a golden opportunity over the last few years for them to maybe win it. In terms, you've got Finn, Stuart Hogg, who's now obviously recently retired. And they've just been so inconsistent in this tournament. Like, they play a great brand, it's easy in the eye, but my goodness, it must be frustrating if you're a Scottish fan. And I'm not sure what to expect from them this weekend at the Aviva.
So Ben, we talked about the fact that England, when they needed a score, and they had that attacking line out and that last minute and a half on the clock, they pulled it off. They were super precise, and Ireland couldn't do enough about it. Scotland had a similar opportunity against Italy. Italy stood firm, and Scotland, to be honest, when I was watching it, there was a sense that they weren't out on their feet, that energy levels were low. And I never really felt, watching that last few minutes, that they were going to crack the Italian defence.
No, Italy, and Capiazzo came up with some big reads on the edge there, like shutting down plays, and they were going wide. And, you know, Russell's a box of tricks. Like, he's a phenomenal player, like absolute phenomenal player. And you can see he was trying to just look for opportunity. He was trying to get to edges. He was trying to create something, you know, what an amazing cross-field kick. Like, literally times up and he puts on the money and up they go again. So I love the way he plays. You know, he is the absolute key clog to them. But you're right, they went multi-phase and are trying to create opportunities. But Italy stayed firm, no penalties. Well, that's what I love as well. Like, they proper back their D, and there was a real trust there. And no one gave away a silly penalty. And you don't always associate that with the Italians. You know, certainly in the past, with infringements and, you know, a pressure moment like that, you know, can sometimes, they haven't always been able to deal with that. But I thought they dealt with that phenomenally well. And I thought that cohesion that they had, you know, a lot of them do play together at Treviso, and that was ultimately the difference. And, you know, you look at it and you thought, you knew Italy could push Scotland, right? But equally, you knew Scotland had had it in them. But, you know, 14-3 up early on. Then, that, like I say, the try just after halftime that gets ruled out, that is a massive moment. And the momentum swings. And then all of a sudden, Italy have got the game almost wrapped up, you know, 3 minutes to go. Then Scotland score again. Then you're a grandstand finish. But like you said, Tom, I think Italian's defence held strong and just deserving. I just think it's great for the tournament. And I'm never going to moan about a Scotland loss, ever.
There's sometimes a sense, like, we have to think hard about Italian victories in the Six Nations because they don't come along very often. But in the past, when they have, there is sometimes the sense, Ben, that they are one-offs, that they are surprises and they won't necessarily be backed up either in that championship or the one that follows. But there is a definite discernible Italian improvement. And I wonder where you think it began and what's causing it, because there is that sense that when they pulled off that win in Cardiff a couple of seasons ago with Capuzzo's break right at the end, that maybe that was the start of it.
Well, exactly right. And I think Italy the last few years have been really building towards something. And then, you know, they went to the World Cup and they're extremely disappointing. But obviously, you know, change of coach, everything's been changed and he comes in. And I've just been really impressed how they play. And like I said, Italy are becoming actually fastly easy on the eye in terms of how they try and move the ball. They try and create opportunities. And actually, they're really enjoyable to watch, you know. And at Rome, the sun's often shining and, you know, you could set in the atmosphere and they almost play to the atmosphere of a sunny day and then move it. And I just think that they're really trying to expand and play a different way, and it'll be great for Italian rugby. And I just really pleased them, to be honest with you, because like I say, for a long time people's expectation is Italy are not where they need to be and don't necessarily compliment the tournament, but I just don't think that's the case anymore. The debate is over, and you know, they, like you say, they've got an opportunity now to go in and finish this tournament against Wales and be 2 wins, 1 draw, which is an unbelievable turnaround to what they have been. Although they've been building towards it, you know, you would never have thought that at the beginning of this tournament.
I'm going to give you a slightly Scottish perspective here and try and turn it around a little bit, because, you know, I'm not saying we're putting the boot in, but we've been slightly critical of them there. You could argue that in the 2 games they've lost, so they've lost to France on a very marginal refereeing call right at the death. And then they've lost to Italy, having had plenty of chances. And arguably, as you say, if that try is not disallowed before half-time, might have been out of sight. So are we being slightly harsh on Scotland here? Are they actually just a couple of refereeing decisions away from going to Dublin trying to win a slam?
No.
No. Look at your face.
No, I'm kidding. No. I'm kidding. No, you know what it is? It's, you know, England rival with Scotland, so it's always, it pains me to... No, I'm kidding. You make a really good point. You know, they could have beaten France, and on another day, that's given. Of course it is. But this weekend, again, that trial, like we said, it just could have, that momentum, I think that would have been gained over Italy, but it wasn't. And that's sport. You know, you've still got to ride that momentum. When Italy then get on the wave and they've got momentum, you still got to stop it. And the Italian tries were very good, well worked, you know, the grubber and then the movement for the other one, the 8 going through and a great well worked try, eventually going through the phases from right and then coming back left and scoring. So look, Italy deserved it. I think Scotland have probably got to be better at those moments where momentum changes and how they deal with that. It's going to be one that's going to hurt them, but What a statement it would be for them if they dust themselves down and go to Aviva and pull off a win, because they've got an opportunity to do something that not many of us think probably possible or feasible by them right now, given their sort of inconsistency of the tournament. But they've got a chance to go there and do something very, very special. And, you know, whilst you've got Finn Russell in your team, like, it's not impossible. I don't see it happening, but it's not impossible. And to be fair, it's probably a free swing for them. You go to the Aviva, you're not expected to win on the back of losing to Italy. You know, there's going to be some angry lads this week within the Scottish camp of that result. And you go in there, the expectation's not on you. The burden's with Ireland in terms of winning the championship at home and all that. Like, you've got a free swing. Now, whether that transpires to a famous Scottish win or not, I've got no idea. But what it could do, and when we talk about the emotional, that is, it's a chance for them to throw the kitchen sink in Ireland without actually having the expectation of them, maybe people thinking they'll do anything.
Right, Ben, we need to talk about the third and final game in this round of Six Nations, which was France winning in Cardiff on Sunday. It's looking very much like Warren Gatland's side are going to be finishing the championship with the wooden spoon. It's a different way of looking at this, I think, Ben. Like, it's definitely not quite clicked as a lot of Welsh fans might have hoped since Gatland's return. But also, there is something about this Welsh team. I don't get the sense, talking to Welsh friends of mine who love their rugby, I don't get the sense of anger or disappointment. I get a sense of realism that actually probably this Welsh team, with the amount of personnel changes and the retirement of so many legends, and then also the injuries to several members of the new guard, this isn't really that far away from where a lot of people thought Wales might be.
Absolutely. I totally agree, because you look at it and you're thinking they've scored some cracking tries throughout the tournament. They've pushed teams for a good amount of games. You know, you've seen some great bits of Wales, you've seen some poor bits, but what you have seen is a team that's on a 4-year cycle under Gatland that's been there and done it. And what they are in 4 years' time is on the back of what they experience now. And they're going for a patch of bad results. But actually, you can be really patient with them because you can see what they're trying to do. You know, I can understand why fans are behind them, and if that, because I would be, because you're looking at them, you're thinking they're a young team, you've got to invest in them. Like, Gatland's putting them out there and they are learning, and they're learning sometimes the hard way, but they're in the games. You know, today they got blown away by the end, right? But, you know, they scored some cracking tries. You know, they're in front of the second half. They're a young team. They're in front of the second half. You know, eventually the French power and the charge down, and, you know, the game gets away from them. But, you know, I think there's plenty to be positive about the Welsh at the moment in terms of, yes, they're not getting the results, but I wouldn't judge them now, because what they are right now isn't what they're going to be in 2, 3, 4 years' time. And actually, when they do get success in 4 years' time, they'll look back at this period, as we mentioned previously on a pod, and they'll actually go, that 2024 Six Nations was kind of the making of this group, because we learnt quickly and we learnt the hard way. So, you know, if they beat Italy at the weekend, you're suddenly looking at it and you're thinking, okay, like, you know, there's, because Italy are going well, as we've mentioned, like, you're looking at that and you're thinking, you know, they could equally go there and beat Italy. I wouldn't be surprised if Wales go and beat Italy. I wouldn't be surprised if Italy beat Wales, but like I say, I think Wales are on a separate journey.
There's also, there's no sense for me that had the leadership been different, that this Welsh side would be going in any sort of different direction. And I don't get that sense from the Welsh supporters either. There's no blame going Gatland's way. There's no sense of what if Gatland hadn't come back? What if the WRU had gone in another direction?
I think, yeah. And I also think that when you pick youth, right, and you go with it with the youngsters, like, people are way more patient, aren't they? They understand that it's going to take a bit of time. But also, Gatland's built such a reputation with Wales. He's so well respected that, like, you know, they're going to trust that he knows what he's doing, and he does. And I think that Wales are, you know, they'll be disappointed in terms of, you know, they wanted to have probably got a couple of scalps this Six Nations. But equally, that they are got an eye on terms of where they want to go. And right now, they're right at the beginning of that journey. And like I say, there's a real sort of understanding of where they want to get to. And this is all part of it, unfortunately. And sometimes you get tough defeats like today. But equally, like I say, second half, they were still in the game for a good while of it. And they scored some cracking tries. They always create opportunities, Wales.
It's been a funny old championship for France, Ben. They've spluttered at times. They flat to deceive. And they haven't really ever given us a sense that they're pushing on from their World Cup disappointment in a way that Ireland had been earlier in the tournament. So that was a much needed win in Cardiff, really. And the way they did it, okay, they're not the France of a year ago, but there were signs, there were reasons for optimism for the French support.
You're spot on, Tom. And I just think, though, like, they've finished well, they've got a bit of momentum now, a big win in Cardiff, you should never shun that, like. And they've sort of stuttered their way in large parts of the tournament, but they'll be back at home. Le Crunch, England game, I think it's a cracker. I really back the boys to go there and win. I think England will go and do the job. I hope France, you get a really good French team turn up, because we want an ultimate test. We want it to be a cracking game, and I'm sure it will be. I'm still not convinced by where the French are probably going, but, you know, today they'll be happy with that win, bonus point win away in Cardiff. And I saw bits of France where they moved it, and I saw the great bits of France, I saw the poor bits of France all in one game. So But it bodes well for this weekend. You know, you think when you really think about this weekend, you've got Wales, Italy. That'll be a cracker, really. And you're looking at France, England again. I can't wait for that. The England challenge. And I say, I really think England will win that. And then you've got Scotland, Ireland. It's a shame that they don't all kick off at the same time, right? You know, like the Premier League finish, where they all kick off at the same time. You know, when the championship's done. I've played in championships before where you've actually found out the team's won the Grand Slam before your game's about to start, and you think, oh, it's actually a killer. What do you reckon? That would be quite cool, Tom. Do you reckon if they all kicked off at the same time, you have that sort of, that finish would be madness, wouldn't it?
So I love it when you get on that final day of the season in football, when the match of the day edit, they're cutting from one game to the other, or if you're watching on Sky or BT, when the little mini screen in the corner of your screen zooms out, there's been a goal at ... So I can see the attraction of that, but look, I've got such fond memories of that final day of the 2015 season when it just built and built and built, where Wales have gone and beaten Italy, and then Ireland have beaten Scotland, and then England take on France at Twickenham, needing to win by a ludicrous margin, and they very nearly pull it off in one of the greatest games of international rugby I've seen at Twickenham. So there is something about those final rounds when they work, and it's tough for the schedulers to look into the future and see what's going to work, but I love it. And also, just entirely from a selfish point of view, if they're all played at the same time, we get to watch one game of rugby, whereas under the current system, we just get to put our feet up and watch three games of rugby.
That is a great point.
Which is rather good. Right, Ben, I've really enjoyed talking about this weekend's action with you. I guess you and I are going to get back together again same time next week, but you have plans before then, of course.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, I'll be back with Dan Cole on Thursday to discuss all things to do with France ahead of the final weekend of this year's Six Nations. Make sure you follow the show on the socials. Keep your comments and questions coming in. We love hearing from you all. If you want this podcast ad-free, go to Amazon Music or pay £1 a week on Apple Podcast app. If you want something else to listen to, try Joe Marler's Things People Do. We'll be back on Thursday. Thank you so much for listening.
For the love of rugby.
Sports Social Podcast Network.